The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Today, I am with Jeffrey Johnson, the owner of Enville Catering. Been around, I believe, since 1982. It's won every award that you can think of in the business. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
Well, thanks for being here.
Yeah.
We've got some great food to go with some of this great wine. And what's really important is to understand the difference wine makes to food and the difference food makes to wine.
Mm-hmm.
It'll change the flavors in the mouth.
And that's one thing I definitely want to get into is just how important is wine with food. Let's talk about the first wine we're drinking, then we'll talk about Enville, and then we'll eat some food and we'll pause because no one wants to hear us chew. The wine we're starting with...
I want to hear you chew.
It's really not that good. You know, people tune out. Is Grosset, which is a producer in Clare Valley, Australia. This is the Grosset Polish Hill Riesling 2006. I got this actually from the National Club. I love this wine. It is a, you know, full-throttled, aggressive, but still fully acidic, beautiful, fruity Riesling. You've never had this one before, have you?
I've never had... this one, I've never had an Australian Riesling, to be very honest.
You've never had an Australian Riesling all your time?
All my time, had an Australian Riesling. I've lived a very sheltered life. for me, this is quite a different Riesling. It's got it's quite aggressive in the first part of the mouth,
mm-hmm.
and it has a very distinctive length. It's not the normal Riesling that I've come to love and admire, the Alsace, the German, and the Canadian Riesling does a remarkable job with Riesling. But this is quite different. I'm not knocking it. It's mm-hmm. it's a good Riesling, but it's something new and
different for you. To me, it would like a lot of lemon lime, you know, a lot of orange. Sort of classic stone fruit notes. It's not a tropical fruit on this, even though it's funny. You think Australia, you think really warm. This reminds me a little more Austrian. And I'm trying to remember who on the podcast said it, is that German Riesling is nicer. Austrian Riesling is a little bit meaner, you know, a little bit more acidic, a little more aggressive. That's what I get on this, but...
There's a dryness in the length that's not typical of Riesling.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends.
Very nice, though.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit, and I'll ask you a question or two, then we'll pause. Because we have all this. We've got lobster. We've got, like, jellyfish salad. We have jellyfish salad. What is jellyfish salad?
It's jellyfish made into a salad.
Okay. I probably should have known that. But
yeah, and there's some seaweed that's made into a salad.
This is very...
And the lobster has not been cooked. It was recently alive.
Okay.
It's now a deceased lobster.
All right. That's kind of depressing. But
And we're going to drink some sake with that.
Oh, okay.
Which is different.
Yes.
And that's going to... And after this Riesling, mm-hmm. and then with the ponzai sauce and the lobster, it's going to be a very different flavor.
And I brought the Riesling. Part of it is because Riesling is so food friendly with the acid.
It
goes with everything, so I thought it'd be perfect with what we're having.
It goes with almost everything.
Yeah, I was debating...
It's not good with pancakes and syrup.
You don't know that.
I have tried it.
Have you really?
Not this one.
No, not this one. Yeah, it probably isn't the best one. I was thinking of Chardonnay because of the lobster, but then when I saw everything else, I was like, nope, I'm going to go Riesling. What was the food and wine scene like when you got started? 1982 here in Toronto.
Oh, it was incredible. There's been a renaissance in Toronto over the last 30, 35 years. When I first came here, it was a culinary wasteland. There were two or three restaurants of any distinction. The majority of social eating was done in hotels, and there was prime rib, there was pickles on the table, white tablecloths, and a lot of waiters from Greece.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work in Toronto. I worked in the Sutton Place Hotel, and that was very typical of the restaurants those days. And we moved up. We moved up in the Nouvelle Cuisine Market in a place called Stop 33, which was on the top of the Sutton Place Hotel. The first really innovative restaurant in Toronto was... was Fenton's by a couple of guys called Pierce and Barrett, and then Dinah Cooing Catering, Roger Sperling.
And where were David these, by Woods. The way? The first one, Fenton, where was it? Where was the location?
Fenton's was off of below Wellesley, off of Young Street,
okay.
on the west
yep.
side.
Mm-hmm.
Just a brilliant. They used to call me when they had beluga caviar come in, a new delivery, and ask me if normal table, Mr. Johnson. That was wonderful, wonderful days. But the change, and everybody now is a foodie, is a chef. We see people coming in for weddings, and everybody now has a very distinct idea of what they want. Also, we're seeing more and more and more, and it's a wonderful thing, mixed cultural weddings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of fun, and we provide authentic food for many cultures.
And by the way, another thing with this, about the Riesling, there's a real purity of fruit, and actually, I am getting a little papaya. I am getting a little bit of tropical fruit. So that was 82. What do you think some of the reasons why things changed? Like when you said we're going through a renaissance, I imagine part of it's the internet and sharing of information is huge.
The food network, the millennials now interest in food and sustainability has had a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers markets, just the health and enjoyment of food. I eat as much organic food as possible. Nothing to do with anything with the health and how good it is for you, but organic food, local food, has much, much better flavors, much, much better taste than the mass-produced stuff brought across from Mexico and California. The flavors there.
One final question, then we'll eat. Then we'll eat. What was your motivation to start on Via? Like, what were you doing before? What your jump from working in restaurants to starting your own catering company?
I was working at the time. I was working at Sutton Place Hotel when I decided to start catering, and I didn't want to be working in somebody's hot, sweaty kitchen when I was 50, 60 years old. So I started on Veal, and the idea was to do a wedding or two a month and a couple of trays of sandwiches, enough to pay the mortgage and enjoy yourself. Now we've got a $1.6 million payroll, and tomorrow we're feeding 2,900 and something guests, which is wonderful.
How many weddings a year, approximately?
Between 65 and 70 a year.
So before it was going to be, you wanted 20, 24 a year would be good. Now you're at 70 and 4,000 other corporate events every month, it seems.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And it's an exciting life. It's a great life. It really is.
I will say this, walking around the kitchen, you have so much life. Like you skip. You just have this real jump in your step when you're wandering through the catacombs of all your kitchens and all your giant fridges. And it reminds you a little bit of The Shining, all these big giant fridges. I don't know if you'll get that reference, but you have this real energy when you wander around your kitchens here.
I've spent my life in kitchens. My father was a chef. My mother was in the restaurant industry, and I get power from the kitchen. I absorb the power and what's going on. It's just something so special. The smells, the noises, the
energy, the life.
The choreography of the kitchen is just something very special.
Okay, we'll pick up on that in a little bit because I want to eat, but the choreography of the kitchen I think is great. So we're going to take a little bit of a break. Next time that you hear from us, we'll be done with jellyfish salad, with seaweed, and with recently deceased lobster. So we'll talk to you in a moment.
Okay.
And we're back after the first dish. And I got to tell you, the jellyfish salad, that was delicious. That was like, it was a weird sort of texture and crunch to it, but it was really good. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I'm glad there was a couple of firsts for you there. The seafoods, seaweed salad and the Raw lobster,
definitely.
Sauce.
Yeah, raw lobster, definitely first. I've had seaweed in the past. I don't ever remember liking it, but I liked it here. And let's talk about the role of sake with what we just had.
Wasn't it? It was just a marriage. It was just really a marriage. There's not a wine that could have supported the raw lobster and the jellyfish and the seaweed come anywhere close to sake.
Yeah,
and it's a very I think we don't know enough about it. We don't drink enough of it. Mm-hmm. We don't really understand it. The best sake I ever had was at Hashimoto in the Japanese cultural center. And this man is a kaisaki chef, and he's one of ranked number three worldwide,
really?
And number one in North America. And he had a sake there that was made with the water was from a mountain spring, and to filter it, they put it into a canvas bag and hung it in a cave with a bucket underneath.
What?
Yes, it was.
Oh my God.
So expensive.
Oh
it
my!
It was just heavenly. It was out of this world. I've never tasted anything like it. It was incredible.
And if you wonder sometimes why something costs so much, I mean, that right there is why. Just the amount of human attention and labor that must have gotten sourcing and rarity. I mean, that's insane. That's nuts.
It is insane. Hashimoto, the whole place is insane. You go there and you'll have the whole restaurant to yourself. There's a transformation. You go through a little maze that really takes you away from the reality and the world outside and places you in Japan. Everybody's in traditional costumes. And the sort of thing that Hashimoto does, he'll have a fisherman in Osaka Bay, he'll row out and catch one fish, and he'll row like blazes back to the shore, run over to Osaka Airport, put the fish in ice and put it on a plane to Canada, and Hashimoto's son is waiting for it to arrive in our airport, in Toronto Airport.
Wait, where is this restaurant in Toronto? Does this still exist?
It still exists.
Where is it? What is it?
It's in the Japanese Cultural Center, which is near Winford Drive.
Yep.
It's quite expensive. There's no menu.
By the way, you didn't need to say it was quite expensive. When they're flying you the fish directly from the lake, I assumed it was expensive.
It is. It is, yeah. So special. It's so special. I was one dish I had there. I've been there quite a few times. One dish I had there, I was actually moved to tears being a chef and seeing the beauty of this dish. It was just an unbelievable experience.
It's funny you say that. I remember there was one time I was moved to tears, and I got choked up. It was an old girlfriend and I, and it was slightly miso glazed black cod, but it was cooked on black stone, and I don't know what was going on, but I remember eating it. I was so confused and happy, and just every positive sensory was every sensory part of me was engaged. And yeah, like there's sometimes you can eat something, you're like, oh my God, good for you, whoever did this.
It's the unami. Mm-hmm. It releases dopamine. Yeah. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Wonderful thing.
Hey, you mentioned you guys on Veal Catering here, you're very much, and it's on the website, very much focused on just on Japanese, Chinese, just Asian cuisine. And by the way, before I continue, how many languages do you speak, Jeffrey Johnson?
I can get through on three or four.
Which ones?
A little Polish. Mm-hmm. French, yep. English, and Cantonese.
And Cantonese.
Wow, look at this. Renee, our executive chef, has just brought in, what is that, Renee? That's rabbit and spätzle.
Blood Brother IPA braised rabbit with spätzle with chives.
Wait, hold on, say it again.
Okay. Blood Brother IPA shumai braised rabbit with Brussels sprouts and double smoked bacon, and European spätzle with fresh chives.
All right, this looks great. Okay.
And where's spätzle from? What country?
Well, it's European, but I would say it's from Switzerland.
And where are you from?
I'm from Switzerland.
It's going to be good.
It's going to be good.
By the way, if we have time, I want you to tell a story. Actually, tell really quick before we eat, and we'll get back in the next just about, because you also speak Cantonese, which is why I brought it up, about just the focus that Enville has on Asian cooking. And I want to get into that. And also, you were talking, just waxing poetically, about just all the multicultural weddings that you guys do here and how you try to service every tradition within a wedding, which I think is great. But enough of you. Explain the story of how you saw The Shining.
Well, I was working for Four Seasons Hotel up in Minaki Lodge, which is about 45 kilometers north of Kenora, very northern Ontario. And Thanksgiving weekend, it was the closing weekend. We closed up on Monday. They started boarding up the windows for the winter and so forth. And then everybody was invited to the cinema. The hotel had a little cinema. And they showed The Shining.
Oh!
And it started to snow the same night. Oh. And then on Tuesday morning, we all went home in different directions.
How scared were you that night when you got home after seeing The Shining and then going to a big, empty, giant resort where it's snowing and it looked like you were exactly at the Overlook Hotel?
It was pretty scary, I must say. I didn't sleep much. Of course, we had to drink all the beer that was left. And then we took the train home back to Toronto.
I love that story. You were telling it to me before. Thank you so much, Chef. This looks awesome. And that is a shockingly scary story. Thank you so much.
Bon appétit.
Thanks, Rene.
Thanks, Rene. Jeffrey, so we'll pick it up right after this meal.
This rabbit looks good.
And we're back. This is the third part. We just finished. This was delicious rabbit. I know some people don't like it because, you know, cute animals. No one likes it when someone eats cute animals. But damn, that was juicy rabbit. And what was... Explain again to the listeners, what was the wheat Swiss?
Spätzle.
Spätzle. Yeah, explain that.
All it is essentially flour, water, and a little bit of seasoning mixed together and passed through a colander into boiling water. Mm-hmm. When you chill it down, it's about a quarter of an inch, half an inch long. Chill it down, and then you can sauté it in butter with chives or a spice, whatever you like. It's really, really good. Really supports rabbit, I thought. And we had Brussels sprout leaves. And we had a 2012 Saint-Joseph by Gugal.
Yep.
What a treat. What do you think of the wine?
100% Syrah. First off, I've interviewed Gugal, so I'm biased. But A, I love Gugal. And as we said before, and I've said this on this podcast, what I appreciate about Gugal is their entry-level Cote de Rhone. It spends a good chunk of time in oak, and he treats it well. Like, the entire organization treats it well. So I always appreciate when the entry-level wine is given respect and a time and attention. With this wine, it's a lovely, you know, blue fruit, you know, a little bit of pepper. You know, this is a really well done. This is what you want from your Northern Rhone Syrah.
Blue fruit. What's blue fruit?
There's a little bit of like blueberry. Like, blue fruit basically for me means when obviously absence of red and where it's not some dark plummy thing going on, where it's
prunish
sort of, it's like a darkish fruit, but it's not really going to give me the intensity of black fruit. So it has more of that blueberry-ish sort of feel to it. So that's what I get here. But I mean, first thing I appreciate is just the alcohol is so well integrated.
It is, and it's not one of these big fruit bombs from California. Matt, how did you get into wine? What was your first real serious wine appreciation? When you interview everybody else.
Yeah.
Let's hear from you.
My stepdad, Sesto, he had a lot of friends and a lot of guys who loved to cook and eat and drink. And one of them was the head of the police union. And they brought over one of the nights when it was just all the men folk. And they brought over all these wines. And one of the bottles that the head of the police union brought over had... and who's actually a member of the National Club, brought over an old bottle of Barolo, and it was brick orange. And I was poured a small glass of it. And I'm like, ew, gross. Because at the time, I liked wine. I didn't know much about
it. It was an old wine?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is a really old Barolo. But at the time, I didn't know a lot about wine. Here's how embarrassing it is. When someone said Merlot, I thought that meant Italian. Exactly. Like, unless we're dealing with a super Tuscan, you're not really going to see much Merlot in Italy. So,
thank God.
We can get into that. Your feelings on super Tuscans are pointed. So, I try this Barolo and I start to laugh and I get goosebumps because it was so good. And I immediately just wanted to take the entire bottle and run up to my bedroom. And I remember I asked, can I pour myself more? They said, yes. I poured it up near to the rim. And I just like, I need to spend time with this wine because it brought me joy. I'm like, what is this? And I was just so excited. So I had that moment. Then at that same Christmas, a similar moment with another Italian. I think it was an Amarone, but an old Amarone in Magnum that, again, my stepdad Sesto opened up for Christmas. And I remember thinking, I'll say this quick, oh my God, look at all this wine. We're not going to finish this. And then smash cut to like an hour later, and I'm calling my older brother. I'm like, Scott, get over here. There's a great wine, but it's not going to last.
So the first glass of Nebbiolo,
yeah,
you wanted to take it up to your bedroom.
Yeah.
That's very telling, Matt.
Yeah.
Very telling.
Yeah, I was a greedy kid.
Yes.
but I was just so like, oh my God, I want to learn everything about it. And I'm very much an all or nothing guy. As I've said 1,000 times on this podcast, if you like everything, you love nothing. I'd rather love a couple things and everything else sort of goes to the wayside. So, you know, when I started to love wine and I just love this glass of Barolo, I'm like, I need to know everything about it. And it was a couple of those sort of moments where I just fell in love with wine.
That's a difficult varietal to as a novice just to fall in love with. That's normally it's a Beaujolais, a Morgon or mm-hmm. something, but go right to the very, very serious Pinot Noir.
It's true. You mentioned, and I want to get back to in a little bit en ville, just with weddings and things like that. But we'll stay here for a second. I always have a push and pull, love hate when it comes to California Cabernet Sauvignon. That's 1995, because most of these wines are mass produced with lots of sugar and chemicals, and they're not actually Cabernet Sauvignon, so they're not varietally correct. And they've got lots of sugar and chemicals, and they're not great. But at the other side of things, these wines also help to get people involved. Like they help to suck people into the world of wine. So I was a push-pull, because on one part of me doesn't like them, but another part of me loves these wines because they turn people who never tried wines, they like these wines, and then they want to explore, and then eventually they explore, and the next thing you know, they're drinking, you know, wines from all over the world.
Well, my thoughts on that is this, that I was born in England, which is almost Europe, mm-hmm. and I was brought up
with, more Europe before Brexit.
My name's Johnson, but I am absolutely no relation to the clown that is running the asylum today. So I was exposed to Burgundy, Bordeaux, Cahors, Languedoc, all of the French wines, Italian wines, Spanish wines, and none of these wines using designer yeasts. They're not using urea to increase the alcohol. All of the yeast, the fermentation is indigenous yeast. It takes a long while to ferment. In the United States, so I was brought up with that. That was my benchmark.
Yeah.
You come to North America, and the benchmark, the first wines that a teenager will drink will probably be Californian. So that eventually becomes the benchmark.
Or Yellowtail. Like it's either going to be California, or it's going to be like Yellowtail, some big Australian fruit bomb that's not very expensive, like Yellowtail, Wolf Blast, something like that.
That's true, but I think North America, you're sticking with Californian. What was the other one that was really cheap and nasty? Fusion.
Yes.
I remember Fusion.
That got started in Quebec, by the way. It got popular in Quebec, and then like a tidal wave of crappy wine just washed onto the shores of Ontario.
It did. And I remember I saw this one. It was about $7-$8 a bottle. So I thought, this would be great for wedding receptions. It's inexpensive, and let's see what it's like. So we bought a bottle in here, and we tasted it. We opened a couple of bottles, and we tasted it, and it was okay. And I thought, well, I'll save that for my lunch. So there was half a bottle left, and one of the guys brought in some braised short ribs. And by the time it has been half an hour open, by the time I poured that into the glass, it had oxidized. It had gone. So the shelf life, or the opening life of this wine, was about 30 minutes maximum. We didn't adopt it as a reception wine. It's just absolute nightmare. And it's just commercial juice.
It is.
Sad.
It is. Now, we'll get more into it, but I want to give a shout out to Renee, the chef. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Renee, awesome.
Just awesome. Like, again, the rabbit, just everything was so good. Was so good. Thank you so much.
Spatzley was awesome.
The Spatzley I've never had before. Oh, my God. It was delicious. That the bacon and the rabbit and everything. Oh, so good.
Enjoy the fromage.
Yeah.
Merci. Tu es très gentil, monsieur. Bonne nuit.
Good night, Mark.
See you
tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Take care, Jeff.
Bye.
Yeah, so I always have a push and pull with those wines because, you know, I think those wines, some of those wines are important because they're the entry-level wines for a lot of wine drinkers.
They get people drinking wine, which is a good thing, no matter what wine it is.
Exactly. So you start there, and then eventually you try other stuff. And I'm not against commercial wine. I'm not against cheap wine. I've got plenty of $8 to $12 bottles of wine that I enjoy. What I have a problem with is when the wine doesn't taste like what the grape says, like varietally correct. If you're going to give me a Napa Cab, there are certain taste profiles I'm looking for, and it's hard to find one.
And what are those taste profiles predicated? And what are they based on? France? Because it's not...
No. I mean, well, some France, you know, some left... Listen, you can get, like, on a warm year, left bank Bordeaux, you can get something that's going to be some similarities in terms of, like, you know, the dark plum, a little bit of chocolate, the tobacco, the things
cassis.
Like that. Yeah, the cassis, that kind of stuff. You'll get that in North America. You'll just get sometimes more of it with a little more body, a little more alcohol. And I don't need every bottle of wine I have to taste like a 2000 Margaux. Actually, Margaux, that's a bad comparison because Margaux's got a lot of Merlot in it. You know, like some of the big Pauillac. Pauillac, thank you. You're better at that than
Le
I am.
Tour.
Yeah. I don't need that in all my wines because sometimes on Wednesday I want a glass of wine, but I'm not going to spend $100 on it or $500 or $700. But it's just my problem is that some of these wines, when they say they're from Napa, it's so expensive. The real estate's so expensive. You can't get a proper version of that wine for $18.95. It doesn't exist without chemical shortcuts.
Chemical shortcuts. It's just gallonage. The wine industry in the States just wants to make money. I think it's a farce the way they speak about their wines. You and I could go today. It's now harvest time in California. We could buy some commercial grape, some Merlot. We could go to the University of California,
UC Davis,
and go and ask for a designer yeast to ferment our wine. So we could then add the designer yeast. Then we want to really give it the big, powerful fruit bomb in the mouth, so we'll add some urea, which will hyperferment it, give it an absolutely huge alcohol content, and a big whack in the mouth. Now, we want to get this to the shelves for Christmas, and it's the same year as the harvest.
No.
So we want to cool down the tannin, so we micro-oxygenate the wine, which is essentially oxygen, a big tank of oxygen, blowing it through micro holes in some liters in the wine. That'll help the tannin settle down, and we can bottle it and get it out on the shelf for $18.50, and we call it Chateau Mat version one.
And by the way, everything that is actually pretty accurate. Like, those are all a lot of the different techniques or shortcuts that wineries...
But you look at Bordeaux. Yeah. You look at Bordeaux.
And Bordeaux does some of that. Like, you'll see the odd place will do a little bit of micro-organization here or there. But, I mean, it's very different.
But the fermentation is indigenous yeast. It comes from the grape skins. It comes from the cellar walls.
And it's not been released the same year.
And it's not being released for four or five years. It's barrel-aging, bottle-aging, and a slow fermentation.
You asked me, so I'll ask. I'll pour. Oh, can you bring the? Oh, there it is. Bringing the wine over. What for you? What's your wine origin story, Jeffrey? Was there a moment when you realized that you needed to just fully envelop your life in wine?
It was a 1960 Chateau Le Tour Pauillac that I paid £8 for.
I hate you so
much. £8. Could you imagine?
No, I can't
imagine.
And
after that moment, I just had to know all about wine and what it was. And my father, when I was a kid, he was a chef. He used to bring home some fantastic foods, and there we were drinking all sorts of great wines. We didn't have a ton of money and a ton of real estate. We had great food and great wine. So I was brought up with it.
Yeah. First off, that's great, the idea of just, you're going to spend it on the wine and the food because That's about bringing family, friends, and everyone together. It's about the experience of the moment. Now, we could go down the road of just celebrating that loveliness. Instead, I'm going to go the other way. I hate these stories. I hate these stories of all you people who buy Bordeaux for incredibly cheap prices.
That's because you're young and you weren't old and couldn't buy it back in the 50s and 60s.
How sad is this that if I got a time machine, there's two things I would do. First, I would go, second, I would kill Hitler. But before that, I would go back in time and buy these great vintages of Burgundy and Bordeaux and save so much money. Then after I got the Latour and the Lafitte and the DRC and all the Chambomoussinis I want, then I would murder Hitler. Then I'd come to current day and I would toast the death of the Fuhrer with a Grand Cru. Like that, like these wines you guys buy for such cheap prices. It's just maddening to the rest of us.
Well, I feel sorry for you, Matt. I've experienced all sorts of Petrus down. Just absolutely
awesome.
I've
never tried Petrus. What's Petrus like?
Petrus?
Please say it's good. It's not bad.
It's wonderful.
Uh-huh.
It's creamy.
Uh-huh.
It's like a hot chocolate on a summer's night. It's just something ethereal.
Mm-hmm.
God sent that to us.
Okay, that's good. I want to hear that answer.
It's good. It's unbelievable.
I didn't want you going, you know, well, it's not bad. I mean, if you have to, you know, if you're going to be
acceptable.
Okay, yeah, exactly. It's acceptable. Because I like to bounce back and forth with Enville Catering. You were talking before just some of the stories about, you know, that you guys do a lot of weddings where it's two people from two completely different backgrounds. You were telling one story of someone from Syria. And I think someone from China was there.
A groom from Syria, bride from China, and we honor both cultures. I think it's important that, and that's the big difference between us and the United States. We're not a melting pot. We respect and enjoy one another's cultures. We arranged a horse for the groom to ride into the ceremony.
Yeah.
And we arranged, a tea ceremony for the mother, for the parents of the bride. Both cultures, absolutely fabulous.
I went to weddingwire.ca. They have 25 reviews of Enfield Catering.
It's all my relatives calling in.
You guys got a 4.9 out of 5.
Well, that's good.
First off, how'd you lose a 0.1? What'd you do wrong? And then second, do you ever read? I think I know the answer. Do you ever read any of the reviews?
No.
That's a smart answer.
Never read them. Some of my people have, and they tell us about them that compliments on the way we help the couple through the event from the planning to the execution, but I've never read them.
Give me some stories. Do you got any, like, and you don't have to give names, either your favorite moments or the biggest horror stories of weddings that Enville has done?
Apart from a bridesmaid knocking down a 4-tier cake.
Give that story.
bridesmaid a little intoxicated by the end of the evening when it just before cutting the cake, she knocked the cake over. That was we put it back together we can. But one of a couple of the amusing stories with weddings is not the wedding itself, but the preparation, because there's a ton of emotion involved with brides, mother in two sets of mother-in-laws, and they're always often in contention. And there was one mother one time, and I offered we're talking about a wedding cake, and I said, you know, a wedding cake is really for show and cutting and taking pictures so that everybody can look at it for the next 25 years on the mantelpiece. So I said, why don't we, instead of having a big five-tier cake, why don't we have a chocolate mousse cake covered in white chocolate shavings, and put some rose petals, put it on a small table, two different levels, a billowed tablecloth, rose petals scattered about, and then you can cut it, get the pictures, which look good, and then we can serve it to the guests. So
that sounds great.
It's edible, it's wonderful, and we could serve it with a raspberry sauce. So the mother looked at the bride and looked at me, and she says to the bride, "Cynthia, when your daughter gets married, you can choose the cake, but we're having rich fruit cake. I wanted a dye." Then another one.
The mother.
So and they
that's not her day. It's the daughter. It's the person getting married.
We see a lot of that.
With
mothers, and we do our best to represent the bride and keep the mothers happy.
Yeah. that must have been interesting.
One bride. This is many, many years ago when receiving lines were very popular. One bride said to me, "Jeffrey, who should be in the receiving line? My mother or my father's wife? I wanted the floor to swallow me up." I said, "This is something you really got to discuss with your father."
Oh,
I
God. Know.
What do you say? What do you say?
What was the final answer on that one?
Well, just, I think you should speak to your father about that. Rather than,
oh, my.
You know, that's a very personal thing. I had to think quick. Another great story.
Yeah, go.
Another great story with weddings. I had when I used to see wedding couples, I had a couple in here, and he was from Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And she was Iranian, complete with
classic wedding.
Classic.
Ireland, Iranian.
So we've got
such a stereotype.
We've got, yes. So we've got Muslim and Catholic coming together. And one,
that must be a tough menu to
put
together.
One doesn't drink. The menu wasn't difficult, but one doesn't drink and one drinks quite well.
Yeah.
So... Came to the stage where I said, "Do you have an officiant to the ceremony to get married?" Because they were getting married in St. Lawrence Hall. I said, "Do you have an officiant?" They said, "No." I said, "Well, we've got a few." I said, "There's one United Church and there's one Unitarian and there's one lovely lady who doesn't bring too much religion into it." I said, "We've even got a rabbi that travels from Winnipeg to Toronto, spends the summer in Toronto as an officiant, marries people." So they looked at one another. So you've got a Northern Irish Catholic boy and an Iranian Muslim girl. They looked at one another and said, "We'll have the rabbi." And I almost fell off my chair. And it was one of the best weddings I've ever.
Oh my God.
Served. The love between this couple was palpable. It was just absolutely wonderful. So two people in love. This is Canada coming together.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great story. Excellent job. I hate when I ask these questions and people don't give specifics. You gave specifics. All right, we're near done. You got a bottle you're saving? Do you have a bottle in your cellar that you look at and go, "This is the bottle I can't wait to open"? You got a great cellar. One of the best bottles of wine, maybe the best bottle of wine I've ever had, was a 2000 Margaux from you. You also shared a 2000 Chateau Latour, which was fantastic. But you got something in your cellar that you're eyeing that you can't wait to open?
There's nothing particular that I can't wait to open. There's some champagnes from 78 that need to be dealt with.
Yes.
I think for me, wine is not a standalone subject. It's got to be married with food. It's got to be married with people. I like drinking wine with you very much. I like drinking wine with a whole bunch of people. There's a whole bunch of people. If they came to my house, I'd look for a lesser wine. So you produce the wine on the table to marry with the food and the company.
Fair.
It's a three-part combination.
Yeah.
So, but in particular, there's nothing in particular that I can't wait to open. There's a whole bucket load of stuff that I can't wait to open, but nothing in particular.
And last question. We're recording this on October 2nd. It'll be released. By the time this comes out, it'll probably be the beginning of November. But tomorrow we have the Black Tie event, National Club. It's Burgundy Night. And I think sometimes people wonder, why the bleep do you guys always are just yammering about two things, Riesling and Burgundy? We've talked a little bit about Riesling. I'm a big fan of the one we had tonight. But what is it about Burgundy? I mean, I tweeted this out on the National Club Twitter account, but what is it about Burgundy that's just so goddamn wonderful and enchanting, and it sucks you in? And if you want to get into Burgundy, make sure your children go to public school, because you're not going to be able to afford private school.
Burgundy, my favorite region, the best region for me in the world is Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. The best wine I've ever drunk is from Burgundy.
That's a great way to put it. I always debate Bordeaux versus Burgundy. I think I've drank more good Bordeaux, but I think the top, oh no. Anyway,
it's,
sorry,
it's, yeah. You can't analyze it.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah,
it's,
you
it's
can.
A difficult thing.
Yeah.
Burgundy, Burgundy too is a risky business.
Yeah.
You get a domain that has a huge name. And because of the laws there, the deaths, the father dies, and the land is then divided up amongst the male children. I think all, not the female.
I think it's women as well, but it's all equally divided among the children.
And the guy that gets the plot of land on the top of the hill, in comparison with the guy that gets the 100 feet that's next to the highway, yeah. The wines are different from chalk and cheese. So you've got to really, really understand the geography and the style of wines in Burgundy. It's a very complex. It's the most complex region for wines ever, I think.
And it's crazy. Like you know, if I took this to sports, I'll tell people, you can stand in the middle of, you know, some of the famous hills in Burgundy, throw a football. You could be standing in an area that makes wines that are $40. Throw the football. Where the football lands, that wine is $700.
You threw it up the hill.
Yeah, you threw it up the hill. Now, not at the top of the hill.
Oh.
But just about 50 feet from the top of now, the top of the hill could be still some great wines and then Premier, but it's so crazy. It's like, okay, top of the hill, very good, maybe Premier Cru. And then as you go down in the middle, Grand Cru. And then you go down a little further, Premier Cru.
And then Village.
And then the closer you get to the highway, it's they sell the grapes to someone else. So, Jeffrey, this has been fantastic. As we end this, tell people, like, I've had two meals, my second meal at Enville Catering with you here. You also helped to cater at the National Club when you catered breakfast once before we did a tour of Ontario wineries. You guys are fantastic. Like, I've never eaten a bad thing here, but tell people if they want, like, phone numbers, websites, whatever, if they want to get a hold of Enville, why should people hire Enville over some of these other hack catering companies?
Well, I tell you, I don't think they're in the top 10 catering companies in Toronto. I don't think there's many hacks. I'm very proud of our industry. I think the quality of food in the top 10 is really, really brilliant. Why should you call Enville?
Yeah.
Is because we service. We understand, we do our best, we give the support, and we really, really care. It's not nonsense, it's not BS, we care. We'll help you through weddings, we'll help the executive assistant through corporate events, and we hold the reputation, we hold the emotions for weddings, we hold the reputations, the brands of corporations in our hands, and we care.
Perfect.
That's why.
Perfect answer. Again, Enville, Enville. It's really easy to find on Google. Yeah, Enville.com. It's easy to find. Jeffrey, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it. And we've still got some cheese.
Yeah. Oh, we still got cheese.
We've still got cheese.
We still
got
a little Riesling to finish. And we got some Northern Rhone Syrah. It's going to be a good time. Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Pleasure. Come again.
Thanks so much for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, iHeartRadio. Yes, I'm on iHeartRadio now. You can also find me Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.